Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Malcolm Russell, writer, journalist, and lifelong mudlark. And we're talking about his book, Mudlarked, Hidden Histories from the River Thames. Malcolm, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
No, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
This is a unique and wonderful history book combined with the thrill of treasure hunting. Where can you lose? How can you lose with a book like that?
Yes.
We got to start out. What is mudlarking?
What is mudlarking? Okay. So at its simplest, what mudlarking means is when the River Thames in London is at low tide, there is a part of the riverbed that is exposed. That's called the foreshore. And over the past 2,000 years, all sorts of objects have found their way into the river. They've been dropped, or cargoes have been spilt as they were loaded onto boats. Sometimes offerings, religious offerings, have been placed in there deliberately. And when the river is at low tide, you can go down onto the foreshore and you can look for these objects. They're not always easy to find, but they can be found, and they were really the starting point for the book.
Now, mudlarking, as it's called, is that term go back to the Victorian period?
Yeah, I mean, the earliest mention of mudlarking that I've come across goes back to the late 18th century. But in the Victorian times, so the 19th century, it was well known that sort of impoverished children and adults would go down and really search for anything that they could sell for a few pennies. So those guys weren't sort of looking for antiquities. They were looking for bits of coal, bits of rope, lost tools, anything that they could really sell to survive.
It's amazing because I've read Mayhew's London Labour and London Poor, and yeah, there's a great plate of a mudlark in that book.
Yeah, he interviews a number of mudlarks in that in that book. I mean, the one that really stuck out for me was a 14-year-old boy that Mayhew interviews. And, you know, this guy, his father had died at a young age, and really he is mudlarking to support the whole family back in, I think, 1851 when that interview was conducted. And his dream find, you know, is to find a shipbuilder's tool that he could maybe sell for a shilling or so. So, yeah, this, although it's a hobby for people like me now, it very much started out as a means of survival back in the Victorian era.
Now, people listening to this may seem amazed that after all these years, you can still find new objects that haven't been discovered yet there on the foreshore.
Yeah, I mean, it still amazes me to be honest. But you know, you've got 2,000. Years of London history, you know, and across that entire period, things have been lost or discarded and so on and so forth. And you can go back even further than then. I mean, I think the oldest finds that have been made in the Thames go way back to the Paleolithic period.
Wow.
That's the oldest period of the Stone Age in Britain. And I think one of the reasons, to answer your question, why you can still find this stuff is that it's cushioned by the mud. So when something's dropped into the river, it kind of sinks into the mud and it gets this nice sort of cushioning that preserves quite fragile objects. So, you know, porcelain, pottery, and even stuff like leather is perfectly preserved in the mud because there's low oxygen there. So, for instance, at the beginning of this year, I went mudlarking and I pulled out, much to my amazement, a perfectly preserved 500-year-old leather shoe sole from the time of Henry VIII. And this thing is in immaculate condition. You can still see the indent where somebody's foot pressed into it 500 years ago. So the mud has got this amazing preservative quality that sort of means we can still find this stuff today.
Well, you write about in the book that the objects are sorted not by chronological age, but by weight.
Yeah. It's, I think like conventional archaeology, you kind of dig down through layers, and the further down you get, the older stuff gets.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the foreshore is the opposite of that. It's chaos, right? So the rivers, the river waters, they sort of erode the foreshore, and they release all of these objects and jumble them up. So, you know, you can find like a McDonald's drawer sitting sort of underneath a Roman coin next to a, you know, Victorian hobnail boot. But that's what kind of makes it interesting.
Oh, yeah.
You never know what corner of the past you're going to end up visiting when you go looking for objects, because as you said, the sort of the river doesn't really sort them by age or what they are. It sort of jumbles all of this stuff up, and you know, it's like a grab bag of history when you go down there.
Now, is the foreshore the only place that you can go mudlarking along the Thames?
You can't, unless you sort of, you know, put on some diving gear, which very few people are prepared to, well, no one is really prepared to do. You have to really wait or go to those areas where, you know, the tide goes down and some of the riverbed is exposed. But one of the stories in the book about the dove's type, this is a very famous typeface that was recovered from the river by a friend of mine. That was actually in the sort of middle of the river channel, and that was actually recovered through hiring Port of London Authority divers who pulled up buckets from the from the middle of the river channel, and that lost typeface was in there. So yeah, there are a couple of other methods that you can use.
Now let's talk about the layout of the book, because this is what makes this book swing. There's 27 different artifact chapters, and each chapter starts with a specific artifact. A lot of them are found by you. And you write about how each artifact reveals a history behind it. And it's usually a hidden history, often by marginalized people. And then as you get into that chapter, there are more photographs, and there's actually paintings and prints and drawings that refer to this history. So there's 27 different aspects of history revealed in this book.
Yeah. So I think the idea behind the book, it wasn't so much to write a sort of history of the objects, of coins or buckles or shoes or whatever. What I really wanted to do is use the objects as the starting point for really thinking about the people that made them or owned them.
Yeah,
or depicted on them, and so on and so forth. And, you know, because a lot of these objects, you know, they are the stuff of ordinary people. Starting point for really delving into these histories of London's kind of forgotten ordinary people, you know, whether they are, you know, it's soldiers, it's beggars, it's sailors, it's sex workers, it's immigrants. So, yeah, mudlarking is an amazing place to sort of start if you really want to investigate the lives of those people that are sort of written out of conventional histories, if you will.
Now, also, before we get into some of the stories, I want to talk about doing mudlarking. There's a great full-page photograph just on the inside front cover of you. I think it's you from the sort of thighs down, kitted out for mudlarking. And you really need some gear to do mudlarking properly.
Well, that's a good question, because actually you don't need a great deal of special stuff. I think it's like a very, you know, democratic way of accessing the past. It's almost like a people's archaeology. If you've got some, as we call them in England, Wellington boots, I think you guys might call them galoshes over in America. You know, if you've got a pair of those, you've got a small trowel, a little bag to put your finds in, that's pretty much all you need. The real skill is in learning to spot the stuff, because most of these finds are tiny, and we call it getting your eye in, and it can take a few months really sort of getting very close down to the ground and learning to spot these tiny items in between the rocks, in the mud, learning which spots are going to produce the finds. And that's where the real patience comes, actually. It's in taking some time to really learn how to find the object.
Now, this is a tidal pursuit too, so you have to be aware of the change in tides. So there's two low tides each day, but they occur at different times. And have you gone out at night mudlarking?
Oh, yeah. So in the second half of the year, the lower tide, the lower of the two tides that happen each day is in a sort of afternoon into the night. And the lower the tide, the more likely you are to find stuff. So, you know, during the second half of the year, I certainly go out on a very regular basis at night. And, you know, that really means, you know, putting a headlight on just to illuminate where you're searching. But you also have to be careful as well. You know, you have to know sort of where your nearest exit is, when the tide is gonna turn, because, you know, at sort of midnight, the last thing I want to be happen to me is getting trapped down there by the incoming waters. But weirdly, because you're sort of focusing so close to the ground, actually searching at night with a torch can sometimes be easier, really, because it really focuses your eyes on the patch you're searching on.
Is there any danger of, like, getting stuck in mud?
Not in central London. In central London, the sort of ground is generally quite firm. But if you go sort of further out towards where the Thames enters the North Sea, it is much, much muddier there. And you have to sort of be aware of the different techniques if you do get stuck, which is really, you know, not panicking and, it's like quicksand, really, not panicking and sort of rolling rather than sort of thrashing around trying to climb out of the mud. Only happened to me once, thankfully.
Now, for people who are listening in the audience, you can't just go out and do this. You actually need a permit, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the foreshore owns the the foreshore is owned by the Port of London Authority, along with the Queen, believe it or not. And yeah, you have to get a permit to mudlock. Now, the reason for that is because it's a sort of archaeological site.
Right.
They want to make sure that anything that is found of archaeological value actually gets shown to the sort of authorities and recorded if required. So it's a good thing, really, because it allows the public to go and find this stuff, but it means it doesn't just get, you know, sold on eBay or whatever. You know, we actually becomes part of the historical record.
Some of these objects are fragments. They're small. Is it really difficult to try to identify what they are?
At first, yeah. I mean, it all just looks like, well, to be honest, most of it is rubbish. You know, at one time or another, this was someone's garbage that was thrown out. So a lot of this stuff is just fragments, little broken bits, very worn pieces of pottery or metal. So, and at first, you know, it can be very hard to distinguish between what's old or interesting and what isn't. But over time, you know, you sort of build up your knowledge. And I've realized, you know, there's an expert in everything. You know, there's an expert in Tudor shoes, there's an expert in lead seals, there are experts in buckles. And eventually you sort of track down these people, you learn from them, and you sort of build up your own knowledge base. But it's a never-ending journey. I mean, you know, 2 millennia of history, every conceivable possible object, you know, every single time I go mudlarking, there's some new little doorway into the past that opens up that I hadn't come across before.
It's amazing the time span of objects in this book, because it starts out with prehistoric tools like microliths and transient adzes, and then it goes all the way up to something that relates to COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the reason I sort of put that time span of objects in the book is I wanted to show that, you know, history is sort of still happening around the Thames. You know, even today, you know, it plays quite an important part in people's lives. So we find a lot of contemporary religious offerings in the river from people of the Hindu Muslim faith and Christian faiths. Actually, you know, it's still being used in some ritual capacity by some people. I mean, unfortunately, you find weapons, you find drugs that have been dumped in there, and, you know, it's you know, these are going to be the finds of tomorrow. This is what the mudlarks in 50 years are going to be getting excited about.
Well, it's funny because I was talking to a friend about the book, and they were asking me if you mentioned, I guess, the band The Clash threw their guitar over when they were sailing down the Thames in their famous concert. And if anybody found it, and I go, it's not in the book, so I can't tell you.
Well, the Clean Air London Calling, I live by the river. So that song does go through my head, actually.
I'm sure it does.
Although my dream find would be something from the Sex Pistols.
Wouldn't that be great? That would be incredible.
You know, which was the Jubilee of 1977,
that's right?
We've got another Jubilee coming up shortly.
As a matter of fact, they're reissuing God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols as we speak. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Malcolm Russell, writer, journalist, and lifelong mudlark. And we're talking about his book, which is just the most wonderful kind of history book, Mudlarked, Hidden Histories from the River Thames. Malcolm, you had talked before about the doves type, and I want you to start out by telling that story. First of all, there's beautiful photography in this book, too. Did you take the photographs, or did other people?
So there was a colleague of mine, Matthew Williams Ellis, took the photography. And what we did is we took the object back to the Thames, to the spots they were found in, and photographed them in situ so the reader can kind of get a feel for,
wow,
you know, this isn't sort of museum shiny stuff. These kind of little scraps that were found under seaweed and in between rocks. And I just kind of wanted to give the reader the flavor that these aren't the sort of, this isn't the stuff that you're used to seeing in museums or in people's collections. It's kind of a bit more worn and battered and everyday. So that's why we did that.
Yeah, but the photographs are of such a quality. They're like museum quality.
Yeah, Matthew did an awesome job. I was super happy with that.
Well, let's talk about dove's type. What is it?
Yeah, so the arts and crafts movement in England, this was like a sort of movement in sort of furniture design, book design, printing, that really took a stance against the sort of Industrial Revolution, so the sort of mass manufacturing of objects in factories. And people that started this movement, what they really wanted to do was return to, you know, handmade quality goods using traditional methods. A bit like the hipster thing we've had for the past 15 years,
yeah.
Right? Artisanal goods again. And two guys started up a book printing business called the Doves Press. And they were two sort of luminaries within the arts and crafts movement. And they started printing books by hand, including an edition of the Bible, and these were highly acclaimed. So they were very collectible. They were lauded in their time. You know, these guys were quite influential on similar movements that happened in America as well, and they worked together for over a decade. But then they fell out, and they fell into a series of business disputes around the sort of the future of the printing press. And they had their own typeface made, so little metal blocks with individual letters on them that they had used to print every single book that the Doves press had made. And when they fell out, there was a dispute over who would get to keep the print. And one of the partners, he was concerned that the other would basically go commercial and not stick to the original principles that they had when they set up the business. And what he eventually ended up doing so that it wouldn't fall into the other's hands is that he threw it all into the River Thames. And by this stage, the guy was 70 years old. He was half a ton of type. And it took him a year and a half putting it in his trouser pockets and walking to the same spot on a bridge over the river and throwing it in. And, you know, after the partners both died, the sort of fame of the Doves Press grew. So anyone who's into typology and rare book collecting kind of knows about this. But everybody thought for 100 years that the type had been lost until a friend of mine did a lot of research. He read the partners' diaries. He read newspaper reports, and he eventually identified the spot that the guy had stood in when he threw the type in. And he hired some divers, and lo and behold, it was there. And what he's now done, this is a friend of mine called Rob Green, has created a digital recreation of the Dubs type using the pieces that he recovered from the Thames. So it's a brilliant sort of story of reincarnation, if you will, using mudlarking.
And it's amazing to see a photograph of the actual type blocks, the little type ingots, which lead off that chapter. I mean, you're actually looking at Dubs type.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And there's only one set of this stuff, and that's it. It's only one, it was pulled out of the River Thames.
Let's talk about coiners. Now, coiners, counterfeiters. The lead photograph is a great counterfeit George III shilling. And what is a coiner?
Yeah, what is a coiner? So a coiner was the name given in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century for people that forged coins. And this was considered a particularly grave offence. It was basically considered an act of treason, which could be punished in the same way as any other form of treason by death. That is, if you were forging silver coins. If you were forging copper coins, you got let off with a couple of years in prison. And, you know, I find these forged coins that would have been made by these coiners, I just find them more interesting than the real thing, because there's a real story behind them and what happened to people that were caught for committing this offence.
Eventually, they were sent to Australia instead of capital punishment.
Yeah, absolutely. So, they were initially sort of sentenced to death, but most of the punishments were not actually carried out. Therefore, the authorities needed to identify a sort of method of punishing them that they could actually follow through with. And initially, coiners were actually sent to America in the late 17th century, to the colonies, obviously, that Britain established there, and then mostly to Australia. And, you know, sending convicts to Australia was obviously a huge contribution to how Britain ended up colonizing that that part of the world. And, you know, there are literally hundreds of thousands of Australians today that can trace their ancestry back to people that were transported there for forging coins in London, you know, back in the beginning of the 19th century.
And this is a great example of how just a small find from the foreshore opens up a huge history.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're the finds that I like best, really. It's where something that seems really inconsequential, maybe even boring to look at, actually has this sort of massive, you know, implication, you know, when you research it. And, you know, London hasn't just been Britain's capital city for hundreds of years. It's also been its biggest port until recently. So I think, you know, a lot of the finds that I find most interesting are those that reveal these global connections between Britain and the rest of the world. You know, obviously, especially in the days of empire, you know, its connections with America, Australia, Canada, and so on.
And a lot of these histories are not ones that people are familiar with. For instance, the history of the Lascars and East India Company.
Yeah, I mean, you know, most, I think sort of, I mean, myself really included, I often thought that, you know, when the British were ruling India, it was when it was part of the British Empire. But I think what a lot of people don't realise is that for 200 years before, you know, the British monarch was the ruler of India, there was a private company called the East India Company that effectively played the role of a government in India, kind of similar to the Hudson's Bay Company, you know, up in Canada. And the East India Company, it raised an army that was bigger than the British Army at the time. It issued its own currency. It exported a whole bunch of commodities to Britain that changed what we eat and what we wear. So tea, for example, you know, the British national drink was effectively introduced by the East India Company. But of course, all of this came at a price. You know, the East India Company kind of really brutally imposed its rule across an entire subcontinent with some fairly catastrophic effects for India. So, you know, I think this is quite an important history that if we really want to understand the world as it is today, we need to know this stuff.
But beyond that, even the British ships were manned by Indian seamen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so there was a whole population of people from India who were in London at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. So what would happen is that a ship would sail out from London to India, and then along the way, some of the British seamen would die of disease, some would die in fights, so that was actually pretty common, some would abscond along the way. So they didn't have enough seamen left to crew the ships back to London, so they would employ Indian crews. These were known as Lascars. And when the ship ships docked back in London, the East India Company was supposed to look after these Indian sailors until they could return home. But more often than not, they just turned them out onto the streets of London. And a lot of these sailors had to make a living, for example, selling prayers on the street or sweeping crossings of animal dung so people could cross without treading in it. And they're actually quite a common sight on the streets of London. And I think most British people kind of think that Britain sort of became a multinational country sort of after the Second World War. And what they don't realise is there was actually quite a visible Indian population a couple of hundred years before that as a result of, you know, these connections.
Now, and under several pieces that are shown in your book, especially I'm talking about the smaller photographs, they're sometimes listed undisclosed location by, say, Monica Butling Smith. Does that mean that's a secret private trove that nobody's giving out the location of?
That's well spotted, actually.
Okay. I wanted to know if that was exactly what that was.
That's exactly what that is. I mean, some people, perfectly understandably, are protective of where they find their stuff because they've spent years sort of learning a particular stretch of foreshore and where to find things, and they don't want to give it away that easily. So, you know, I wanted to respect that, you know, with those entries in the book.
It was a red flag. I immediately started thinking about, I wonder if we can deduce where they came from. We're completely out of time. We could talk about this book for years. My guest tonight has been Malcolm Russell, writer, journalist, and lifelong mudlark. And we've been talking about his book, Mudlarked, Hidden Histories from the River Thames. Malcolm, brilliant book.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.